You are listening to How on Earth, and today, the Conference of World Affairs is happening this week on the University of Colorado Boulder campus and at other venues around the city. Each year at this time, KGNU hosts a series of panels with the Conference of World Affairs throughout the week. Today's How on Earth show is a special edition in conjunction with CWA Panel 2056 entitled New Adventures in Astronomy. Our guest is Gerrit Verschuler, a radio astronomer, as opposed to me being an astronomer on the radio. Dr. Verschuler has worked with Jodrell Bank Radio Observatory in the United Kingdom, the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in West Virginia, and Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. Dr. Verschuler also was a faculty member here at the University of Colorado Boulder and was the first director of the Fisk Planetarium. His work has ranged from measuring the interstellar magnetic field to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence to measuring the small-scale structure in the cosmic microwave background. He has published numerous books, including The Invisible Universe, The Story of Radio Astronomy, and Impact, The Threat of Comets and Asteroids. Welcome to How on Earth, Gerrit.
Thank you, Joel. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is really great to have you here, and thanks to the Conference of World Affairs to bringing you out. I want to just start off. Your Conference of World Affairs bio has a line that says you were the first person to see the moon's surface up close by a remarkable twist of fate. So I have to bite. Do tell, what is the story behind that?
Yeah, it's the Russians landed Lunik 9 on the moon in 1966, and Jodrell Bank in England had a program where they would track Russian spacecraft, and the Russians knew that, and they collaborated. So one morning when I came in to work, there were 100 reporters there, and I heard that during the night, Jodrell Bank had tracked the Russian spacecraft, which landed on the moon. And to cut a long story short, that spacecraft carried a fax machine. But it was a fax machine based on the fax machines that we knew the Russians had used in an experiment with Jodrell years before. So they took a fax machine from the West, took the bits and pieces out of it, and landed it on the moon. So during the night, the Jodrell people heard the signal, and one of the top people said, hey, that's a fax machine. I recognize it. Let's see if we can get a fax machine here and play the signal from the moon. Well, they did that, and there was nothing on it. The tape recording had nothing. So during the morning, because I was on the staff, I inveigled my way into the little room where all the equipment was, and the director, Bernard Lovell, said, when the moon rises, why don't we just play the signal straight into the fax machine as opposed to using a tape recorder? And So when the moon rose, and I was there listening to it, and there were these sounds, and, oh, it's working. But then they developed the photograph, and there was nothing on it. It was half black and half white. And this happened after we already knew that the Russians had not received any faxes from the moon the previous day, because there was a Eurovision link all over Europe, sort of trumpeting their wonderful landing on the moon and the first pictures from the spacecraft, and there was nothing. So Lovell, after we got this half black, half white picture, he said, well, it's obviously failed. So he ushered everybody out to the conference room and to go and tell the reporters, this has failed, go home. And that was it. But I stuck around, and there was a little tent that the Daily Express technicians who brought the fax machine up from London during the night, in which they developed the photograph, because it took 5 minutes to get a photograph to the fax machine. Well, as I was standing there, the signal came in again, and the guys took the plate off of the disc and went into the dark room. And after a while, I heard the guy say, we seem to have something. And he hands me the tray of Fixer out of the little tent. And there in my hands was the first photograph from the surface of the moon ever by anybody.
By fax?
By fax. A fax that they was bought in the Western Hemisphere, but landed in a very clever spacecraft, which had these petals. When they unfolded, no matter how it landed, it would be horizontal. And they just took these pictures. And what happened after that is another story. But that was incredibly exciting because I actually told Neil Armstrong the story on an eclipse cruise and sat at a bar with him one night. And I said, I always wanted to go to the moon, but this is the closest I ever got. Yeah.
Closer than anyone at the time there.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Well, that's great. One of the things I love about astronomy is its connection with history and things like that. And it's great to hear these stories, especially from a first-person perspective. So getting into the topic of the panel for today, the new adventures in astronomy, I wanted to just kind of create a setting here first. Before looking forward, we've already looked back a little bit. Can you tell me what were the significant new adventures in astronomy that you have seen over your career?
Well, because my career goes back to 1961, that was in the days before quasars were discovered, and I remember vividly the discussions we would have because they discovered these strange sources, which seemed to be double, and nobody had any idea what they were. So that was a big deal. And when they finally were identified as being the cores of galaxies with black holes emitting clouds of stuff in two directions, so they explained the double. That was incredibly exciting. And then, of course, when the pulsars were discovered, that was also a pretty major mystery. And
that was the little green men mystery.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And, back, you know, I point out to folks, back in the early 60s, it was possible to know everything about radio astronomy. And we actually read every paper that was published every year because there was so little. So when I wrote my first edition of The Invisible Universe, I wrote it off the top of my head because I'd seen most of the
literature
things
already.
Yes.
So, and experienced it.
Yes. But then more recent, do you want to go to something more recent?
Sure.
I think one of the most exciting things that's happening right now is the discovery of fast radio bursts, which are, in their turn, totally mysterious. They were discovered by accident years ago in some folks at West Virginia. And these are just a sudden burst of radio emission from unknown sources. And I think a dozen or so are now known. But the most exciting part of that is that Arecibo Observatory, when they were re-observing a few of them, one of them actually repeated. And it's now known as the repeating fast radio burst. And it's the only one that's been observed to repeat. And why this is important was the original theories were, well, great big burst of radio waves from outer space, something blew up. But when they found the repeating burst, it meant that it was not destroyed, whatever it had been or was. So that's where we are now. The first radio burst was observed at Arecibo, and then they started doing systematic measurements with other observatories, and they actually pinpointed the object, and it's in a galaxy about 3 billion light years away. But it uses this incredibly strong radio burst, and nobody has any idea why. And that's one of the big topics of research now, because this is utterly mysterious.
It seems like a lot of astronomy has followed these observations, unexpected observations of sudden phenomena that are hard to track down because it's gone. You don't have GRBs and things like that. So these mysteries do take a little work to try to follow up. So these are mysteries and new adventures in astronomy in the past. Starting to look a little forward, putting on your hat and looking in the crystal ball, what do you think of as far as new adventures in astronomy?
That's a tough one, because in my experience, we never know what's going to happen next.
That's true.
You know, I was thinking there are a few discoveries also made at Arecibo which are puzzling and which, if we solve them, may make a big difference to what we understand about the universe. One of them is that there's a so-called radio astron program, which uses a spacecraft as another element in the radio receiver. And they simulate telescopes which are almost as large as the Earth-Moon distance. And doing that, they have observed in a certain quasar that the object is very, very, very small, but it's very, very bright, and that means you can calculate how much energy is involved.
So you can measure these small angles because even though it's not necessarily a big telescope itself, it has this very long baseline.
That's right, yeah.
And it's that distance rather than the collecting area that allows you to see that detail.
Now, we've known for a long time why radio sources emit radio waves called the synchrotron process. But these very long baseline observations using the Russian spacecraft show that that theory may be wrong. After having accepted it for the last 40 years, there's something wrong with it because this source is brighter than it should be. And that is quite extraordinary. So now they're planning a lot more observations to see if they can first confirm that and also perhaps look at some other sources.
So brighter than it should be
by the theory, right? According to the theory, which has been accepted for so many years. So that's a very
strange
thing.
As theories tend to be until new evidence comes in.
Yeah. And then there's the other fascinating thing, and I am biased towards Arecibo here, but they were able to use the so-called very long baseline interferometer to measure the motion of stars in the Pleiades cluster. You can actually see them moving around, and that enables you to get the distance to the Pleiades. And our knowledge of the size of the universe depends entirely on this basic measurement of distance to the Pleiades.
It's the first rung in that cosmic ladder distance scale.
Yes, that's right. And there were measurements of that. But then they launched, Arecibo came up with a very accurate distance to the Pleiades. But then there was a spacecraft that was launched, whose name slips my mind. The whole purpose was to measure this basic distance. And the two results, it disagreed totally. So the skeptics said, oh, Arecibo can't be right. This famous spacecraft's got to be correct. But then another spacecraft was launched called Gaia, and it confirmed the Arecibo result. But the Arecibo result is extremely accurate. So now we have a very good idea of, quote, how big the distance, how large the universe is.
So Arecibo and Gaia, their measurements were...
Now overlap. But Arecibo is much more accurate than Gaia.
So it gives... Having as accurate as possible those first few measurements would propagate through all the other distances as well.
Yeah.
So Arecibo has the gold ribbon for that right now.
Absolutely, yes.
So knowing the distance to objects in the universe is important because we want to understand how big it is, and a lot of astronomy is based on how far away things are. So we can measure how bright they are or how big they are or things like that. Going out to the extreme distances, all the way out to the cosmic microwave background. Now, those measurements are done a little differently, but you've worked in that field as well, is that correct?
Yes, the cosmic microwave background has been observed in detail by a spacecraft called WMAP, and more recently by one called Planck. And what they do is they remove from their observations all the known phenomena that are occurring in the foreground. They apply what they call a foreground mask, and they subtract what they think is being produced in interstellar space.
It's all that contamination from our galaxy.
Yes, that's right, from the dust in the galaxy and so on. And then they end up with all these little structures, which they think then must be the seeds for future evolution of galaxies.
So the idea is that those small bits that are kind of implanted on the cosmic microwave background are density differences that eventually create galaxies.
Essentially, yeah. And those are distances of the order of 13 billion light years away. But I have discovered I discovered it by accident when I was working on my book, The Invisible Universe, that the small-scale structure in the cosmic microwave background seems to correlate with structure in the galactic hydrogen maps. And that was tantamount to heresy, because that would imply that the signals would be a few hundred light years as opposed to a few 13 billion light years away. And then most recently, I found that I could actually explain the signal by invoking electrons between the stars in clouds of gas, but cold electrons. And the cosmologists had never considered that there would be a signal due to cold electrons in interstellar space. But we know they exist. And then it turned out that I could explain the so-called spectrum of the cosmic microwave background small-scale structure using this galactic source, this source of emission. And that's where it is right now. I know the cosmologists are now taking it seriously because I can tell from the number of downloads of my paper, or our paper. I wrote this with my wife, published last December. And where we go from here, I'm not quite sure. I did some observations recently at Arecibo to try and confirm the theory, but it ended up revealing something completely unexpected, and that's about a week old, so I don't know what to talk about yet.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, fresh data, sometimes you need to let it ripen.
Marinate.
Yes,
right,
perhaps that's a better word, right? Yeah. So these cold or low-energy electrons,
yes,
these are foreground in our galaxy. Again, it's another noise above the background,
yes,
signal that needs to be subtracted.
That's right.
Before we can see the real background structure.
Yes.
So so you think that maybe the cosmologists are starting to take this seriously? Have you worked with the team from WMAP and others to discuss this a little more and maybe make that correction?
No, they prefer not to talk to me. when I now look at the data that I'm now working on and think about what it implies, it may mean that there's no small-scale structure in the cosmic microwave background, which is heresy.
So you think your data could actually account for,
yes,
all of the small-scale,
yes,
structure that they're seeing?
Currently, I think that. But my ideas have what's called a half-life. You see how long they last before they're shown to be wrong.
Sure, sure. Well, that's part of the business in science.
Yes, it is.
Sometimes we spend a good chunk of our time trying to prove ourselves wrong.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so it's a fascinating topic. And you know, I've written a lot about the thrill of discovery when you discover something new. And when I, for instance, measured the magnetic field of the strength of the interstellar magnetic field, the first time I actually saw data online, it was an ecstatic experience because I'd been working on it for 8 years and hadn't seen anything. But when I saw this phenomenon that I'm talking about with the cosmic microwave background, that was not a thrill. My first reaction was, oh my God, this can't be real.
this is real, and now you have to deal with...
Well, a huge amount of work has been put into WMAP and Planck with $1 billion of investment in spacecraft. And here I spend maybe $500 on ink to print out color maps. And I'm saying, hey, guys, you missed something.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't make the missions worthless. It just means that there's additional considerations that they need to take into account.
Yes.
And that's why it's helpful to have people who work in the field but not on the mission, and even in other fields, looking at the data. You know, it's part of the feedback loop that goes on in science.
Yes. And you talk about looking at the data. That's what I literally do. And my concern, and I'm going to voice this at the Conference on World Affairs, is that too much of the big science today involves people not looking at the data. The data go into the computer and something comes out the other end. And they never stop to actually look at a few areas to see what the computer actually did.
And sometimes that's what grad students or postdocs are for.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a strange time to be in astronomy because of the big projects are hiding your mystery phenomena that you'll never see unless you look at the data.
Well, there are discussions and conferences going on about how to deal with big data.
Yes.
Because a lot of these projects and missions are creating terabytes of data trying to sift through. And in a way, you can think of it as a treasure trove for future generations.
Yes.
But sometimes if you just skim the cream off the top, you miss some of the important details.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
If you've just joined us, you are listening to How on Earth, a KGNU Science Show. I'm Joel Parker. Our guest is astronomer Dr. Gerrit Verschuur, who is in town this week as a panelist at the Conference of World Affairs being held at the CU Boulder campus. We are talking about new adventures in astronomy. Let me go from distant to close here. I believe you have also worked on near-Earth objects and the risk of impacts and impending doom to the Earth. Tell us a little about your work there and what you see there as new adventures in astronomy.
Well, I got into this years ago when I'm not quite sure how I got into it, but I wrote a book called Impact, The Threat of Comets and Asteroids, and the two famous film movies that were made happened soon after that, and I'm sure that I triggered the imaginations of certain screenwriters. But anyway, this is a very real threat, and Arecibo Observatory, with which I'm associated, is tasked by NASA to track these near-Earth objects when they look like they might threaten the Earth. Because the Arecibo radar, a 1 megawatt radar, it can bounce signals off these asteroids and plot their orbits precisely, so you can determine whether or not they will strike.
So you can you beam out a signal
and pick up the echo,
and it comes back over how great of a distance?
Oh, several times the moon's distance. And that's the only way to do this, to be sure where these asteroids are going. And NASA has a mandate from Congress to make sure that we do this. But the tragedy is that Arecibo Observatory is being threatened with closure because one of the one of the organizations that funds it, the National Science Foundation, wants to pull out. But NASA, I don't think will allow that to happen, but still we're in this turmoil right now as to how to continue funding for the next 5 years.
This has been an ongoing issue with a lot of observatories where what used to be the big grand telescope, 4-meter telescopes even, are now considered small and not the next shiny thing, and they either get closed or have to be taken over by a consortium or some private university or institute.
That's right, yeah. And it's tough finding money these days.
It's very difficult. So what has your work at Arecibo involved? Some of us have seen it perhaps in the movie Contact, I think.
Yes.
You know, a big dish in the ground there in Puerto Rico. But what is an astronomer's day or night like at Arecibo?
Well, I've been using results of a survey already carried out at Arecibo of interstellar hydrogen gas, which they've mapped with extraordinary precision. And what that's really showing us is that we didn't know anything about interstellar hydrogen gas before these very high-resolution observations. So that is fascinating to work with. So I have access to the data that these other guys obtained, and I'm working with that on a daily basis, actually.
It seems that, you know, another of these sub-stories in astronomy is every time some new window is opened up, whether that window is in wavelength or the window is in time or in resolution,
very good.
We discover many new things that are a little different than what we expected before.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, whenever you can see more clearly, you can see more clearly. And then what you thought was out there isn't quite the way you thought it was. And that is fascinating to me anyway.
So what is your hope for the coming years, say the next decade in astronomy? Can you pick one thing that you're looking forward to?
Gee, I never considered that question.
Because you're so busy looking at the data you have now.
That's right, yeah. Now, I think that one of the most important things will be to clarify this foreground structure in the cosmic microwave background data analysis until I'm convinced that they've done the right job or they're convinced that I've done the right job. That is really important, because if it turns out that there is very little structure in the cosmic microwave background, then we're back to square one as to figuring out why galaxies exist. So, but it's very hard work and tiring, and I'm getting older, and I wish that some folks would say, hey, I'd like to work with you on that, but there's too much at stake here for a lot of the cosmologists to even suggest something like that.
Well, we appreciate the scientists who spend the time, the long hours, digging into the data.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for being on our show, Garrett.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Joel.
That was radio astronomer Dr. Garrett Verschoor talking about new adventures in astronomy as part of the Conference on World Affairs being held at the CU Boulder campus this week. For more information about the conference, visit cwa.colorado.edu. And as a plug for another astronomy-related topic, I will be moderating, producing a panel tonight at Fisk Planetarium, Garrett's old stomping grounds, at 6 o'clock this evening. The panel is called The Emotional and Artistic Resonance of Science, and it will feature NASA astronomer Michelle Thaler, followed by a screening of the full-dome film Bella Gaia. That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our executive producer is Susan Moran. This week's show was produced and engineered by yours truly, Joel Parker. Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Visit our website at howonearthradio.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and you can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Questions or comments? Call KJNU Comment Line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KJNU Science Show, I'm Joel Parker.
This program is made possible by you, the KGNU listener member, and by Fisk Planetarium on the CU Boulder campus, providing innovative astronomy, science, and artistic programs since 1975. More information at colorado.edu/Fisk or by calling 303-492-5002.
It is 10 seconds and 1 minute past 9 o'clock on this Tuesday morning. You are listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. The weather forecast for today, mostly sunny with a high of 67, low tonight of 43, and in fact sunny throughout the week in the 60s to 70s. So enjoy this beautiful weather. That is your weather forecast. For your moon forecast, it is a full moon, so when the sun sets, turn around and look behind you, and you'll see a beautiful full moon rising in the constellation Libra. That moon has somewhere on it an old fax machine, as we just learned earlier this morning. The next new moon is April 26th. The next full moon is May 10th.